The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to take matters slightly out of order. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3149.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have the dash one amendments. Is that right? So I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3149.
And those are the ones dated 3411.
I assume so. Unfortunately, I'm not able to see those electronically, but I have a hard copy. Yes, dated March 4th, 2011.
Motion is made to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 3149. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, the dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
As amended?
As amended. Thank you.
It's been moved that House Bill 3149, as amended, be moved to the floor with a...
Mr. Chair, I think I may have read incorrectly. I thought that that had a subsequent referral already attached to it. That does not. So,
restate your motion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3149 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 3149 pass the floor as amended. Is there discussion? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a question to the entire committee. There's a lot of responsibility, obligation, liability placed on the personal vehicle sharing program. And my question is, and I think I missed part of this discussion, so if someone from the committee could answer that, who would be the primary opponents or who would be the primary owners of the program? A program, personal vehicle sharing program. Is it private entities?
Do you want to address that, Representative Widener?
That would be fine. It is a private entity that plays the middleman and would be handling the liability and...
Privately held?
Yeah, privately held.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a little bit of discussion on this. I think one of the, and I think it's a creative idea. I think it's a neat idea. And the fact that San Francisco has been doing it for 3 months is very cool. I'd like to see them do a little bit more before we jump in with both feet. I'm trying to sort of separate the business end from the legislative end of allowing them through statute to be able to conduct business like this. What really caused me some pause here was the person that had the BMW that gave it to that somebody borrowed and they ground down the gears, and I was trying to figure out what the mechanism was to satisfy that sort of problem, and it sounded like the mechanism was, well, we saw the problem, so we paid it out a settlement to them. I'm not sure that's a real sustainable solution, because you have a pool of early adopters that are really excited about the program that are going to be very optimistic about everything. And I'm just worried that as this gets broader base and more people are involved, that those sort of claims start to really come into the system, and that we in Oregon are going to see the Attorney General's Office or Department of Business and Consumer Services getting some of these sort of complaints. And so although I like the idea and I think it's a really creative idea, I'd probably be more excited about doing the idea if I didn't know that San Francisco was already starting. I kind of like to see them sort of work out some of the details before we jump in with both feet. So I'm supportive of the concept, but I'm going to be a no on this right now, so I hope I don't offend anybody.
Little doubt of that, Representative, given the fact that I think there will be opportunities to amend it in Senate. So your comments are noted. Are there further comments on the bill? I would just say, in very much a partial response to your concerns, that I think that folks that are probably at greatest risk here or should be mostly concerned are the insurance carriers that are being asked to develop a product to meet this kind of unusual arrangement. And it seems to me that if they had had a concern about at least the liability, they would have said something, and they did not. I understand that there are Co-Chair Reed.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chair. I agree with your statement, with the only slight amendment that we did receive an email earlier from Farmers Insurance indicating not advocacy, but that they were satisfied with the way the bill had been constructed, that they could deal with that.
Right, and I think that it appeared to me that those folks were probably the most likely ones to express concern, and I agree with you. I think there were actually three companies I saw that were neutral on the issue. And then I read the bill again in preparation for the meeting and noted that the organization has to acquire insurance and hold the folks who own the vehicles harmless from liability should a third party be operating the vehicle. So I am satisfied to move it to the Senate. Personally, is there further discussion? Yes, Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly am, well, I'm not exactly sure that I would want to do this, to tell you the truth. It doesn't seem to be a program that right now I would want to. But I don't want to keep other people that have an interest in doing this from doing it. So I'm very happy to support this and have it as an option for those people. I'm just not sure I would see the benefit myself.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan.
Just a quick clarification, Mr. Chair. I'm not concerned about the liability so much as like the comprehensive damage that might happen with some of these cars that you would have, you know, scratch and dents and things that don't become a really big issue when there's a fleet involved with a management company and one singular ownership interest.
Representative Lindsay, did you have something?
Yeah, just partial response to my colleague, Representative Sheehan, is I'm going to be voting yes on this for the fact that the owners of these entities, those that are investing in this, they're the ones that are going to be weighing the risk, whether they're going to take it on the chin or not, and coupled with the insurance agencies. So as long as this is the private sector taking the risk and hopefully gaining a great reward with it and great return on investment, I think it's a valuable risk that we should allow them to take.
Further comment? See none. Would clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay.
Yes.
Representative Nathanson.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative
Weiner? Aye.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
No.
Chair Vance?
Aye.
And Chair Reed?
Aye. The bill passes to the floor as amended. And the next, I'm going to open. I'm sorry, we need a carrier. We do need
the
a carrier.
The chair would suggest Representative Cannon might want to carry
he would.
His own bill.
It is his bill, yes. Yes, I see a nod from the. Yes, Representative Cannon will carry. With that, I'll close the work session on 3149 and open a work session on HB 2166. Zach.
House Bill 2166 is the fourth version of Connect Oregon. It authorizes insurance of lottery bonds for transportation projects funded from the Multimodal Transportation Fund.
Mr. Chair, I'm searching for the correct amendments here. I believe they're also dash ones. I think I've even got them electronically now. And they are. So I would move the dash one amendments dated February 24th, 2011 to House Bill 2166.
Co-Chair Reed has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2166 dated 2/24/11. Is there a discussion?
Chair, the effect of the amendments are to change the amount in the bill from $100 million to $40 million. I think many of us on the committee would be interested in retaining the $100 million, and perhaps the good folks in Ways and Means, including the co-chair of the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee who serves on this committee, will find a way to do that. But the $40 million matches up with what is in the governor's recommended budget.
So further discussion in regard to the amendment? Representative Weiner.
I'm glad to see that we cut it tremendously, in all honesty, because our debt service was getting pretty high, but I still am leery to be moving this and increasing the bonding. I think we need to learn to pay for projects rather than be bonding a lot of these projects, so I don't know if I'll be supporting this today.
Your comments are as to the amendment?
As to the amendment, I'm happy that it's gone from 100 to 40, so I will be supporting the amendment,
Thank you.
I don't know if I'll be supporting the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Is there objection to the dash one amendment? Seeing none, the dash one amendment is adopted, and that brings us to Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2166 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Reed, or Co-Chair Reed, has moved that House Bill 2166 move to the floor with a due pass as amended, move to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but with a...
And that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
As stated. Is there discussion? Yes.
Thank you. Byer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I'm very, very supportive of the Connect Oregon projects and hope to keep them going. But, again, this bill will be down in Ways and Means, while we'll have to weigh it with the rest of the policy and expenditure bills down there. And would love to have it.
Further discussion, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was growing up in the 70s, we used to have the Sears magazine, you remember those big, thick things, and the way that you would buy something, they had a good, better, best. Good was kind of the lower end. Of course, the best was the higher end. And I would rank this bill as mediocre, below best. I think we can do a lot better. I'll be voting yes today, but I'm not happy with the bill as it is. I think a couple things that I'd like to see in the future are, one, instead of grants, this should be a low-interest loan. Just as we do in the private market, we get loans, low-interest loans that you can go out and leverage. You can do that. It just doesn't have to be a grant. Second thing is, we have, as a poster child for Connect Oregon, the poster child is the small rural communities that are doing these projects. Yet they're not the primary beneficiaries. They do receive them, but they're not the primary ones that are receiving it. I would like to see this in the future get narrowed down to the rural communities, and of course what I said about changing it to a loan instead of grant. I'll be voting yes today, but I think we can do a lot better.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Chair Vance?
Aye. The bill passes. We need a carrier.
No.
You'll sure, maybe we don't.
Well, we don't.
It's going on.
Oh, I'm
to,
sorry. It's going on. No, I'm sorry. We don't need to carry it down to that committee, do we? So the House Bill 2166 passes to the floor. I'll see if I can get this right, Zach, with a, as amended, with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Perfect.
Okay, good. Okay, with that, I'll close the work session on HB 2166 and open a work session on 2179. Zach.
House Bill 2179 permits counties to use local registration fees to pay for debt service and costs related to bonding or other obligations.
And Mr. Chair, do we have amendments needed on 2179?
No.
I see none. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2179 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I think there's a
subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. No, not by prior reference. Excuse me. Let me start over again.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2179 to the Committee on Revenue with a due pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 2179 passed to with a due pass recommendation, but with a referral to revenue. I think that's still pretty well garbled.
Surely my fault, Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Sheehan.
Mr. Chair, again, I apologize. I'm going to have to be a no on this just because of the area that I represent and the drama and trouble that's going on between my county and the Selwood Bridge project. So I'm going to respectfully be a no on this.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
Yes.
Representative Nathanson?
Yes.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Byer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
No.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Chair Vance?
Aye. House Bill 2179 passes. We don't need a carrier, do we? So, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2179, and we will open an informational meeting and a public hearing on House Bill 2207 because some of the folks testifying may wish to talk about both. And with that, we will ask Art James, who's been patiently waiting, to give us an overview of electrical vehicles. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Art James. I work in the Office of Innovative Partnerships for the Oregon Department of Transportation here in Salem. And I have a PowerPoint. Is that on? I'm going to quickly do an overview and then bring up some of the partners that have been involved in the EV efforts. The Office of Innovative Partnerships was created by the legislature in 2003 and basically enabled the Department of Transportation to pursue transportation projects as public-private partnerships. And we were actually approached in 2008 by a company that was a delivery company that was having problems because of gas prices spiking over $4 a gallon in the summer of 2008. And they said, can you use your public-private partnership authority to figure out a way to put charging infrastructure around the state so as if we invest in the vehicles, there'll be a place to charge them. And we organized a workshop in Portland late that year, and we're just amazed. We had almost 80 companies show up with interest and enthusiasm on this subject area. So what I'd like to do is kind of bring you up to speed on what has happened since then. Basically, Oregon has been trying to position ourselves as the premier launch site for electric vehicles. And ODOT, along with other partners, have helped to court various manufacturers of the state. We signed the first memorandum of understanding with Nissan North America in late 2008 to name Oregon as the launch site for the Nissan Leaf. And you may have heard recent news reports. The first Leafs are actually began rolling into the state in late last year, and some of the members of the audience here actually are signed up to receive those. We've had subsequent agreements with Ford Motor Company, with Mitsubishi Motors, and other manufacturers. We found that it's an easy sell. Oregon is an ideal market for these types of vehicles. We have a moderate climate. We've got shorter commute times than many other states. And our land use laws have developed these urban growth boundaries, which make for compact development, which is ideally suited for these types of vehicles. And Oregon has a very collaborative approach in how we're dealing with both the electric vehicle manufacturers and the companies that make the charging infrastructure. I've heard repeatedly in my conversations with neighboring states that they're amazed that we can all get around the table, sit together, the utilities, the regulatory agencies, the local governments, state governments, and figure out solutions to problems as they come up as we start rolling out this infrastructure. And you're going to hear from some of those partners immediately after my presentation, and you'll see how unusual it is, I think, that we all know each other and we all work together almost on a daily basis. So the vehicles, these are all electric vehicle manufacturers that have been here in the state, brought their products here. The one on the top left is the Nissan Leaf. This is a vehicle that gets about 100 miles per charge. As I say, they're the first mass-produced all-battery electric vehicle to hit the market. Nissan really is kind of leading the way in that sector. The next two vehicles down on this slide and on this poster over here are two Ford Motor Company releases. One is the electric Ford Focus. This one has gotten quite a bit of notoriety. It's been Jay Leno has one. It's been on the Jay Leno show. They also have the Transit Connect, which is a small delivery van. This van actually was the truck of the year last year on the gas platform, and I believe is really going to be a game changer for a lot of the small businesses that run set delivery routes because the economics of driving an electric delivery van over a gas car. The Think Car, this is a Norwegian company that actually was looking at Oregon to assemble and manufacture this vehicle. We were in discussions with them about possibly using the Freightliner facility. When that changed, Daimler changed their plans. They decided to manufacture that in Indiana. They decided they're still going to bring these vehicles into the U.S., and we'll start seeing them on the roads. The next vehicle down is the Navistar E-Star. This is a 12,000-pound gross weight delivery van, full electric, and it had its worldwide release in Portland last year in May at the Portland Convention Center. The next one is the Chevy Volt. This one's getting an awful lot of notoriety. This is a referred to as an extended vehicle, extended range vehicle. It can drive for about 40 miles on the battery alone. Then a gas motor kicks in and recharges the battery, so it doesn't actually propel the car, but it charges the battery. The vehicle has about a 300-mile range overall. The electric smart car that's available at the Beaverton Smart facility, and they're actually have some for sale and also to drive there. And the Mitsubishi iMEV also will be available later this year. Toyota has a plug-in Prius, and I believe there may be some down here you might hear from later presenters. And that's theirs drives on the battery just for about the first 12 miles, then it turns into a normal hybrid. So, why charging infrastructure, and why is ODOT in this sector? Well, the biggest limitation for EV drivers is the range of the vehicles, and we refer to this as range anxiety. So having a reliable network of charging stations out there will encourage people to buy these cars and invest in the technologies. There is a kind of a dilemma here in that the EV manufacturers tell us that we need to have charging infrastructure out there before people will buy the cars, but we also don't want to make major public investments in charging infrastructure if the cars don't arrive. So we're trying to balance that right now and phase in the charging infrastructure as the vehicles are arriving. We do know that about 75% to 80% of the charging will take place in people's homes, so that's the first thing to take care of. The next biggest area is in the workplace as people charge up at work, and then the final one is what's referred to as public charging or convenience charging, which is out kind of ubiquitously in the community. There are very quickly three levels of charging. A level one charge is a standard 15-amp plug like you'd have in your home or in the office or here at the Capitol. It takes a very long time to charge these cars that have big batteries using a level one or what's sometimes referred to as a trickle charge. Level 2 charging is a 240-volt, 30-amp connection. These are the primary ones that we're going to see popping up around in Oregon, and one of the later presenters has actually brought a model of one into the room here. There's also a higher level than that, which is a DC fast charge, 480 three-phase connection, and this actually can charge a vehicle in 20 to 30 minutes. You're going to hear subsequently from Ecotality, which is a company that we're working with very closely on the EV project. They received a large federal grant to install in several states. This and we're helping to kind of set the table for them here in Oregon, and I'll wait and let a subsequent presenter give you the details on that. But I did want to mention that we, ODOT and state agencies, jointly developed a deployment guideline book, which is available on the ODOT website, probably one of the best kind of how-to manuals for either companies or public jurisdictions that want to consider installing charging infrastructure. It has a lot of great data and photos, et cetera. Just a brief note on House Bill 2207. There are a number of state agencies that want to take a leadership role in showing that the state supports this movement towards transportation electrification. And in order to do that, we need the ability to dispense electricity at state facilities. And really having the main purpose of that, raising the awareness of the public and installing these charging stations in high visibility locations, like in front of the state capitol. We actually had conversations with the folks in legislative administration about what would it take to put one out there where people who come to testify at the Capitol might come and plug in. Other agencies like Higher Ed, Department of Energy, ODOT are looking at that as a possibility. In February of last year, the governors of Oregon, Washington, California, and the premier of British Columbia signed a compact establishing a green highway initiative. And this is really trying to envision the day when you would be able to drive an electric car all the way from BC to Baja, and we're cooperating with our neighbors to the north and south, trying to figure out logistically what it's going to take to make that happen. ODOT received a $700,000 grant from the stimulus funds from the Department of Energy last year to extend DC fast charge network from Eugene down to Ashland. And the EV project that I mentioned earlier is primarily from Portland down to Eugene. This amount of funding that we got will allow us to extend that network down to the California border, installing the fast charge units every 25 to 30 miles. This is a list of the interchanges and just a map of where those are kind of targeted to go, and we're right now in the process of identifying the locations along that route for installations. We also received a grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation in October of last year, $2 million to extend this fast charge network in northwest Oregon. This will allow us to provide another 20 fast chargers along major transportation corridors to destinations where people in the urban areas are going to want to go, and underserved communities on the coast, in the gorge, and towards the Cascades. We're coordinating very closely with Washington Department of Transportation on delivering this. We've jointly developed site criteria, technical specifications for the equipment. The idea is we want to make sure that we have a common charging experience for the driving public as they're heading up and down this green highway corridor. Some of the other efforts that we've adopted, signage for these electric vehicle charging stations. We identified a problem that they had in California where ICE vehicles or internal combustion engine vehicles would park in EV charging spots. So we developed and adopted with Washington a sign for no parking except for while charging electric vehicles. We've also petitioned Federal Highway Administration to change their sign for electric vehicle charging stations. Their sign had a symbol of a gas pump with the EV, with the initials EV on it, and a lot of the EV advocates really objected to this. You know, why are we using the gas pump as our symbol? So we're working with the Federal Highway Administration to change that to a plug, just because it's more intuitive. That makes a lot of sense. We're very fortunate in Oregon to have a statewide building code, and the Building Codes Agency sits on the advisory team that I chair. They've done some really inventive things to streamline permitting and inspection for installing these stations. On the residential side, they adopted a change in their administrative procedures, which allow them to inspect only 1 in 10 once they've certified a contractor as being qualified in this area. And that's going to be a big boon to local governments that have cut back their planning and permitting and inspection staffs. So that's just one example of some of the things that we've been able to do to accelerate this effort. So for 2011 and beyond, we're going to continue to work with Nissan and EcoTality on the deployment of this charging infrastructure through the federal grant that they received. Their brand name is the Blink Network. We'll continue to promote EVs as a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reliance on imported petroleum. Oregonians right now spend nearly $7 billion every year that comes out of the Oregon economy and goes elsewhere to other countries. And that's the more we can keep here, the more that will be reinvested in the Oregon economy. We intend to deliver on the fast charge networks that we've been awarded through these two federal grants, and we want to be an example in the nation on how to get that done. We'll continue to explore with our neighbors opportunities to grow this green highway, and we have almost monthly conference calls with California, Washington, and British Columbia to figure out ways to do that. And there's also a movement, and you're going to hear a bill on Friday, regarding a road user fee for electric vehicles in House Bill 2328. I think the final message I just want to give is that they seem to be really coming this time. The electric vehicle is, for any of you that have followed it, that sort of come in fits and starts. There's a famous movie called Who Killed the Electric Car that came out, and it was about the California experiment. I think we've learned an awful lot from that. That same filmmaker is coming out with a film this spring called The Revenge of the Electric Car. And every auto manufacturer has announced plans for some type of a plug-in vehicle to be introduced within the next 2 to 3 years, and we're actually seeing them rolling down the Oregon highways right now. So that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. James. Questions while we have him up here? Representative Lindsay.
A couple, please. A couple of questions.
Sure. Right in.
Thanks. First of all, maybe we should change the name Green Highway to something else. Let's see here. First question is what does it mean to launch this LEAF here in Oregon? Are we doing any manufacturing? If not, what can we do to get that manufacturing here? Or are they just using us as branding, as Oregon is the green state? Are they just using us? What does it mean to launch?
Well, co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, we actually met with the CEO of Nissan and signed an MOU with them saying that we would begin putting in charging infrastructure in exchange for them launching their vehicle here, meaning they're available in Oregon before they're available in other states. That's kind of what launch is. Now, you're going to hear from the Business Development Department later about the sort of nascent industry cluster that we have in Oregon of companies that are trying to get into this space right now on the manufacturing side, on the development side, on the software side. And so I think having the vehicles here and having EV manufacturers looking to Oregon as a premier launch site raises the profile for the state to be able to attract both manufacturing and growing our own industries here.
And then my second question is, and maybe if you can't answer, maybe someone else can, is how did the gasoline station network, when motor vehicles first came out, how did that get started? Did it have government help to get some infrastructure in place? And then part two of that question is I would think Harvard Business School talks a lot about creative destruction. Hollywood videos are going the way just because of industries is maturing. I would think that the Chevrons of the world, the Shells of the world, would be seeing the writing on the wall and maybe wanting just to have service both EV stations and other stations. Can you address those two? How did the gasoline station network get started? And the second is... is there any talks among those industries about offering both at a gasoline station?
Co-chairs and Representative Lindsay, I don't think I'm qualified to answer the first one. I'm really not a historian in terms of the development of the gasoline distribution network. That's something that probably ODOT would be able to answer. I can take that back, and we can find an answer to that. With respect to the second question, yes, the petroleum industry is looking at this as a way to sort of increase their business. And one of the things about this Ecotality EV project is to test out various business models on how to make the dispensing of electricity a viable business model. And I know that they have signed up BP as one of the partners in the deployment. So I think Mr. Mayfield may be able to talk about in terms of deploying some of this infrastructure at gas stations. I know we've been approached at ODOT by a lot of the travel plazas along the interstates that want to put in charging infrastructure and they want to learn from us on how to do that. It's a different business model than dispensing petroleum because the electricity is so cheap in the Pacific Northwest. So you need to have other services and activities going on in order to make that a viable business.
Follow up,
please.
Yeah, I think that a system is already good in place there. And just looking at 2207 in Section 1, Sub 3, it says state agencies may provide electric power purchased at state expense for the purpose of recharging privately owned. I would suggest that's probably not a good business model. Are you telling me that the state would be paying to fill? If I had an EV, that the state, I could go and have the state recharge me for free?
Co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, The reason that bill is worded the way it is there are available some charging stations that state agencies have an interest in installing, and early on there may not be a mechanism to collect for that. For instance, if there were a charging station in front of the state capitol and someone in the audience drove and plugged in their car for, say, an hour to be in a hearing, the value of the electricity that they're going to put in their battery during that hour is so small that it would far outweigh the transaction costs of using a debit card or something like that to pay for it. So as when the numbers are very small, it may behoove the public entity, in order to encourage this transition, to provide that electricity. As soon as the numbers get large, where there are many electric vehicles out there, and it might have an impact greater than pennies, that bill would not require anybody to do that. So,
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like this is definitely the way things are going, and it seems a lot more mature of an emerging market than we were 6 or 7 years ago with hydrogen, but you've got the hydrogen highway in California. Were we able to learn any lessons from that in devising a plan here, or does it give us any caveats or risk factors that we need to be aware of moving forward?
Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and Representative Sheehan, the hydrogen has almost been like a mirage. There's been huge amounts of R&D put in that over the decades, and it was always kind of like it's still 10 years away, and 10 years go by, and it's still 10 years out. I think what's really happening in the EV world right now is there have been huge breakthroughs in battery technology, and that's what's changing the game right now. The batteries are lighter, they hold more, they're less expensive, they're non-toxic, they're recyclable, and so that whole battery transition is changing the game for electric vehicles, I believe.
Mr. Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you please repeat the point that you made toward the end of your presentation about how many millions or billions of dollars we spend on filling our cars and trucks, and that's money going out of state or out of country, and what that's like to turn that around to be spending it on an energy source that would be reinvested in Oregon?
Co-Chair, as Representative Nathanson, there's actually a tremendous report put out by a group called the Electrification Coalition, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank made up of major players in this area. And it has a whole section on the enormous wealth transfer that takes place every year as Americans buy imported oil from the oil-producing countries. And I confirmed this just this week with the Oregon Department of Energy. Oregon's share of that is almost $6 billion. And that's $6 billion that Oregonians are now paying. It's going out of the Oregon economy to companies, to countries that in some cases are not friendly to us. And if you look at the turmoil going on in the Middle East right now, there's a lot of instability in those countries. So the more we can produce renewable energy here in Oregon to fuel our transportation system, that's going to really cut down on how much of that percentage of our economy goes out of state. We probably are not going to get off of petroleum entirely in the next 50 years, but if we can get a significant portion of the fleet transition to electric cars, or at least some form of plug-in car that's using renewable energy, it's going to go a long way towards solving that problem.
A brief follow-up?
Sure.
Will you please let me know or the committee know through a subsequent communication if there are any economists in Oregon who have written anything more detailed about that for this state?
Yes, I will.
About the value of moving toward purchasing our own produced energy. Thank you.
Further questions? Just a couple, Mr. James. The battery technology, I think you said they're lighter, better, last longer. Where are we, in your opinion, when it comes to the distance being expanded from 70 or 80 or whatever it is, or just battery-operated cars? How much longer until it's 300 miles?
Representative Bence, It actually is 300 miles right now, but it's very expensive to go 300 miles. There's a vehicle called the Tesla that's manufactured in California that has a 300-mile range, and it is a hot sports car. It costs about $112,000, so it's not really affordable for most people, but that's because of the cost of the batteries. They have a lot of batteries in them. Now, there's a lot of R&D going into the battery technology right now, and most of the experts think that it's going to be similar to what's happened in computer memory, in that 3, 5, 10 years out, the batteries will hold more, they'll be cheaper to produce, they'll be lighter, and very similar model. And some of the subsequent speakers, perhaps from PGE and others, who have actually gone and visited some of these battery plants in Asia and other places, it's really extraordinary what's happening now. And nobody knows exactly what the business model that's going to prevail with the public is going to have, because you've got right now the plug-in hybrid, you've got the extended range vehicle, you've got the all-battery electric vehicle, and one or the other of those, or variations of that, will emerge as being the hot new technology for the public.
Representative Smith, if you had more, I have a follow-up on this. The batteries, the main component is what? Is it lithium? Or
lithium.
And there was some indication that China controlled most of it, or was purchasing the areas that had most of it. How much truth is there to that?
Co-Chair Bentz, there's a lot of articles written on that subject area. China does have very large deposits. There's also a major deposit in Bolivia under a big salt lake that is as much as 50% of the whole world's supply. Some people have actually talked about Bolivia as being the next Saudi Arabia of electric cars. Nobody really knows on that, but there are some deposits in the U.S. and Canada. It's a fairly common mineral, and I think that will be the best thing about it is it's non-toxic. It's not like the old lead-acid batteries that were let out gases and whatnot. It's 100% recyclable and fairly plentiful.
I have some other questions on a different topic, so we'll go to Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'll do the flip of that. I'll ask just the question I have that's related to your questions, and then I'll hold off for my others. I heard you say that the anticipated growth in battery memory is projected to be similar as what we saw with computer growth memory. Sorry to sort of term drop, but, so I assume you're talking about sort of Moore's Law. And my impression has been is, woefully underinformed, but my impression has been that battery trajectory hasn't come close to matching what's happened with memory trajectory. And in fact, it's one of the great limits of laptops and cell phones, et cetera. And maybe we're getting it figured out for cars, and maybe China's getting it figured out, but it does seem that there's physical limitations with holding of a charge that are different than the physical limitations of the transferring of a charge. And if you can either help me on that a little bit or provide some more information afterward, that would be great.
Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Smith, you're correct. It's not exponential like the Moore's Law equations,
right,
but it is. It is making major advances, I think, is the point I was trying to make. Similar in the fact that as more and more research goes into it and more breakthroughs happen, I think the batteries of today are very different than the batteries of 5 years ago and the batteries 5 years from now. There's a company in Albany, an Oregon company, Entech, which is actually doing some major R&D right now on the membranes for the lithium batteries and preparing for the next generation of electric vehicles. It's really, there are some, I think, some exciting things that are going to happen, but you're correct, it's not on the same scale as Moore's Law.
Thanks. I'll turn it back over to the chair, but the reason I ask, partly out of curiosity and partly because, this is a major topic for us to figure out. I think often we are I'm a big fan of electric car vehicles. A buddy of mine owns a company in Eugene, trying to launch that very thing. And at some point, we're still moving around a whole lot of metal. right? And so is there, as we look for ways to use energy more efficiently, right, are we looking for cheaper lunches and free lunches when, in fact, maybe neither really exist? And so anyway, I'm a fan of the electric car stuff. I think we should be making a move on it. I think it does fit with a sort of economic brand. And at the same time, I want us to keep our thinking caps on and be candid about, you know, how are we well, anyway, about how we're actually going to address the future.
I'm curious. I want to build on Representative Lindsay's remarks about the evolution of the gasoline station. What I would like to know is if folks have given some thought to when this situation would flip, because it would seem to me it would be when gas rises far enough and people go, we're not paying it anymore, and they decide to find something different. Do you folks have some idea of when that might occur, in the sense that, is it $10 a gallon? Is it $5 a gallon? Is it $20 a gallon? And suddenly everybody says, we've got to have an electric car. I'm just curious if there's been studies that tell us at what point we can anticipate that sudden realization that it's time to do something different.
Co-Chair Betts, there's a number of research papers on that, and there's an excellent firm called Pike Research in Portland that did some predictions on what the adoption rate is going to be on EVs. And obviously, gas prices is a big part of that. I mentioned at the very beginning that we were first contacted in 2008 when gas prices went over $4. Well, it's almost certain that's going to happen this summer, and a lot of the pundits are now saying it's going to be five a year from now. So people will start looking at the difference in technologies with greater interest as soon as that tips. Nobody right now knows exactly what that number is, and I can provide some of the studies, some of the predictions of people that are more steeped in that than I am, but that's definitely a big factor.
I guess the vision that I have is the day that happens, and let's look a year after that day, you need a field the size of Eugene to hold all the cars that are parked trying to recharge on the way to California. And I'm just curious about how that plays into your discussions.
Co-Chair Vance, right now people base their vehicle purchasing decisions oftentimes on the maximum use they're going to have on a vehicle. So somebody might buy a very large truck or SUV to haul their boat to the lake just because they only do that three times a year. I think what we're going to see in the EV market, people who have maybe two cars in the family, and one is the commuter car that's driving 20, 30 miles a day back and forth, the other one an extended range car for when you want to pick up and go to Florida or San Francisco. That's the way the market is going to evolve, I believe, in the next decade or so.
Thank you. Further questions? Commissioner Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your question about the tipping point is a good one, and it reminds me of what we sometimes say in the Revenue Committee about the only thing we know about a forecast is that it's going to be wrong. We don't know which direction. I'm curious if you could help us on some of the alternative models that are out there. It's nice to see the charging stations and have Oregon at the forefront about that. I recall at some point reading about I think it may have been in Israel, a business model where a driver drives into a station and simply swaps batteries. Is that still viable? Are there other alternatives that are being considered and developed?
Co-Chair Reed, that company is actually called Better Place, and they're headquartered in San Francisco. They've been up here to visit with us and talked about their model. Frankly, when we talk with the electric car manufacturers, many of them really didn't think that was a model that was going to work, primarily because the car manufacturers like to differentiate their product. And the battery swapping station requires a standardized battery. And you can tell from looking at the poster, these cars come in all different shapes and sizes. And so the Israel experiment is being undertaken by Better Place. They're in partner with Renault, which is building a fleet of vehicles that will all have standardized batteries. these batteries are big and heavy, too. I mean, you've got to imagine a 700-pound object being removed from a car, stored somewhere to be charged, another one stuck in, and then having all of that water-sealed and engineered so you can drive on an Oregon road. Those are all things that many of the EV manufacturers indicated to us that they thought they were non-starters.
Nice way to finish. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next two folks are David Mayfield and Charlie Alcock from Equality and Ecotality, is that what that is? And Portland General Electric. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I'm David Mayfield, and thank you, Representative Ben, Co-Chair Benz and Co-Chair Reed, for having us here. I do have a presentation, but before the lights go out, I did bring the Level 2 wall-mounted electric vehicle charging unit in here, and that there will be 900 of those installed in Oregon by September of this year, at least.
Installed where?
In people's homes and at fleet locations. We will also be putting some of those units in parking garages as well. Oh, thank you. This is my presentation.
And as long as you mention it, is there a car with each one of those units then, so we have at least 900 of them in this state? Is that what you're telling us?
That is our hope. That is our hope. We currently have about 600 people who have signed up for the Nissan Leaf. Yeah. Yes. I have my presentation is now ready to show, yes, thank you very much. Okay, I am with Ecotality North America. We are a publicly traded firm. Our home offices are in San Francisco, and we have a long history with electric vehicles dating back to the early 90s. And the California experiment. And since the 90s, we've been involved very closely with the Department of Energy with testing of electric vehicles, battery technology, and plug-in hybrids. So as a consequence, we got the EV project, which is, in fact, a study of driver behavior and how they're going to be charging their cars, but it is also a study in revenue models. That is, how do we come up with a business model where we don't rely on taxpayer or ratepayer funding? How can we develop a self-sustaining system? And so we're experimenting with that during this two-year study, and Oregon is one of six states plus Washington, D.C. that is participating in that. What you see here are the numbers just associated with Oregon. We have a $16 to $20 million investment in the EV project in Oregon, representing over 2,000 electric vehicle charging stations in various locations. As a result of this work, Ecotality currently has five full-time employees in Oregon, all locals, as well as supporting about 25 other jobs right now. Those people are working rather full-time on helping us with the installations. So you know, over the past year, working with the Oregon Advisory Team and the great partners I have with the state of Oregon and the utilities such as PGE and PacifiCorp and EWEB, we've been able to do planning on where to locate these charging stations. And as a result, we have mapping in the metropolitan areas in the Willamette Valley. In this particular case, red is high density for publicly available charging stations, and green is medium density. So we have a game plan, and we're now currently implementing that. This is the map of the Eugene Springfield area. You will see those little circles on the map represent community input and suggested locations for charging stations. So that is something we're also paying attention to as we go about installations. So we did our just, I guess it was last week, time flies, last week or the week before, we did our first installation of the first residential unit of this style, of the wall-mounted unit, and thank you, Co-Chair Reed, for providing a statement for that release. It was very, very helpful. It was a great turnout, and we also, you probably saw, or some of you may have seen us in the newspaper this morning with announcement of a partnership with Fred Meyer to provide public charging stations at their locations. So things are rolling for us in Oregon. This is the pedestal unit, so this will be the primary one that you will see out in publicly available places. And it is a level 2. It has a universal plug on it so that almost all of the vehicles that will be driving in Oregon will be able to use this unit. More as important as the charging stations itself is we hear about the Blink Charger. Well, it's attached to the Blink network, and the network is really crucial to helping us with our business model to try to figure out how to pay for continued maintenance of the system. And it also provides services for people using the charging equipment. How do you find these chargers? Well, you can find them on the map on the screen in your Nissan Leaf. But you can also, with Blink, you'll be able to get on your smartphone and find out which stations are occupied. Or in the future, be able to reserve a station if you happen to have a very time-sensitive day and you need to be rest assured that you have a charge available to you at a particular place. We'll also have services to help you plan out your day in that regard. So we are also supporting, because it is a universal plug, is available to all the cars that will be released in Oregon, and we're really hoping that the local manufacturers will be able to take advantage of our network. Now, I'm showing here the Arcimoto Pulse that will be manufactured in Eugene, Oregon. Art James mentioned the importance of the fast charge network, and that has to do with people being able to use their electric vehicles throughout the state and not feel extremely constrained in having ownership of one of these vehicles. This is the map that the Oregon Advisory Team helped Ecotality produce to show the preliminary layout for fast charge stations in the northwest of our state. This happens to be the Blink fast charge unit that we will be placing in 23 of those locations. As you can see, it has two ports, and that large screen on top is a media screen, and part of the revenue that we're hoping to generate and to help support the network would come from media released on that screen. So it's an idea. It might work, might not, but it's something that we're going to be testing. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes,
just from a standpoint of developing this, and I'm looking at your cables and everything coming out of there, wouldn't it make more sense just to set up a plug, then the manufacturers of the car, this is the type of plug that we have at the stations, you just pull the cord out and plug into it?
That's a very good question, co-chairs and Representative Widener. I appreciate that question. And in fact, that is the kind of technology that the level one charging stations do employ, is having a cord come from the car to the unit. The standard of having a cord and this J1772 connector is a national standard that is accepted. And we have no choice in terms of the technology. And there are advantages and disadvantages to having the cord attached to the equipment.
Yes, Reverend Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed one of the slides you had data services that were built into the station. Is that, or could that support the metering of the, I guess, electric fuel that's being put into the vehicle? And could that support like a tax system at some point?
Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Reed, Representative Sheehan, yes. The equipment is smart. That is, it has two-way communication through the web, and it has an internal revenue grade meter in it, which is equivalent or better than what the electrical meters are. And in fact, it can be used for a variety of purposes. Including, for example, application of smart grid technologies if you want to take advantage of getting more renewable energy into electric vehicle batteries, or as you say, the utilities themselves could conceivably be accessing and using the data. Governments can certainly. May certainly have an opportunity to take advantage of that data as well.
Okay. Chair, just a couple of quick follow-ups. Sure. And just for terminology, so that's one of the one-hour charge machines, and the one we saw there that was the two-nozzle machine is like a 20-minute?
Yes. This one here, it would in 1 hour, would give you perhaps a 12 to 22 mile kind of range from the charge, and to fully charge it would be more like 4 hours. But for convenience charging in public, we're expecting people to be plugged in around 45 minutes to 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours.
And the cost of a home model now versus when you have a scaled operation and you're efficient, and as far as how many units you're able to get out there, the cost of that unit as right now versus later when producing them at a decent cost. I assume it's very expensive right now.
Well, co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, right now it's $1,195 for that unit right there. What we find is that the cost of the installation is equivalent or possibly quite often more than the cost of the unit itself.
Further questions? Representative Weiner.
You probably thought of this, but I'm just thinking with the engineering hat on, but looking at your station, wouldn't it be real easy just to put a card reader where a guy could run his debit card through there and then you just bill him by the time that he's traveled or the kilowatts that he's used?
Yes, co-chairs and Representative Widener, this is the Blink card, okay, that would be associated with the units that we will be putting out in Oregon this year. This is a smart card, and so it's not going to be used with a card swipe. You just tap it against the unit, and it'll communicate with
RFID.
The unit. Yes, RFID. And because we have so many different connections through the Internet or through Wi-Fi, this is considered to be a safer technology in terms of identity theft. And we're going to be using this, or you will have other ways to turn on the equipment using putting in your credit card number on a smartphone or something of that nature. The fast charge may, in fact, have a swipe card on it as well, but I'm not entirely positive about that.
So you have an arrangement with Fred Meyer. Is that free? Is Fred Meyer doing it as a courtesy to their guests, or is there some sort of a charge arrangement?
Representative Benz and Representative Reed, part of our program is to cost share with revenue share with all the hosts. So when we sign a contract with them, we want to make sure that they are repaid more than enough to compensate them for their expenses, including electricity.
The device that we were looking at over there has to be hooked up to the household electrical system, and you were saying that it costs more to do that. Is that because of the level of power you have to deliver to that particular machine? Is that what's costing so much in the house? What were you referring to?
Yes, co-chairs, what I was referring to is typically the trenching from or the installation costs from the parking site to the electrical panel of the house or the business. If it's a short distance, it can be very inexpensive. But if it's in the 30, 40, 80-foot range, it could approach $6,000 to $10,000.
The I guess I'm, my real question is, what's the, what was it, a 210? What do you hook up to? Is it like a dryer outlet? What kind of volume of electricity you need to power coming to that device?
That is correct. It is a 208 to 240 volt, typically 40 amp circuit.
If I come down to my car, which happens to be parked next to co-chair Reed's, and he has arrived early and stolen the one hookup, is there some way I can sneak it off his car and get it on mine, thus robbing...
Mr. Chair, if I arrived there first, how would I have stolen it?
I'm sorry, well, I will assume that well. I'm entitled to it. But in any event, is it locked on to his car somehow so that I can't possibly... rob him of the, you know, have to push his car home now. What happens there?
Yes, oh, co-chairs. What happens is, okay, when if this is a publicly available station and Representative Reed has plugged in, and if you chose to do so, you could disconnect his car and plug in your car. In doing so, the Blink Network would send a signal to his smartphone to let him know that there was an interrupt in charge. So if he was fast enough, he could find you.
It's not that far to Ontario.
It's a big if about his speed. So,
physical only, right, Mr. Chair?
No, I guess my question is, there's lots of folks that are going to want to plug in if this happens.
Yes.
And how do you stop this arm wrestling over who gets to?
Well, initially, we'll be putting enough stations out there where for the first few years, I think people are pretty guaranteed to be polite. But our hope is that there will be pressure to put in more stations and that our business will thrive. That in fact, there will be demand for our products and that as well as our competitors, and that we will have more and more stations. With the Blink Network, and with the opportunity to be able to reserve a space or to determine which spaces are available from a remote distance, we hope that people will treat each other a little more civilly.
Now, the real question is, what does it cost? So is it the cost by an hour? What's the cost, and how do you measure it?
For the level 2 unit such as this, we're going to be assessing an hourly cost, and we don't have that nailed down yet, what that will be, but it's going to be, just to throw out a number, say for example something like $1.50 or something of that nature in per hour. For the fast charger, it'll be charged by the minute.
And can you convert that for us to miles?
In terms of miles, that might be, say, 7. Again, it's that figure is not exact, but say maybe it's 7 cents or something per mile. But that, again, that's as an example. It's just a range. We're not sure what that will be exactly, and we will release that in May of this year.
And then, of course, to really pin you down, how much is that for power, and how much for the machine and the handiness of doing this?
Well, because we are service providers, we are not selling electricity. So in terms of what the cost is, it's the cost of the service, the whole package, the Blink Network, operation and maintenance of the equipment. The entire package.
I didn't quite answer the question. How much is the power costing to recharge the battery for an hour, let's say?
Very little. Very little.
Right.
In the range of probably 7 to 10 cents.
Okay, so the markup is $1.50 over the 7 to 10 cents.
No, that's a kilowatt hour.
Oh, per kilowatt hour. Okay. So that's times 10 or 12. Yeah. I don't have a price. We haven't released any kind of pricing on this, so I'm really not prepared to drill down into this.
The issue comes up nicely under the bill that the hearing is open on now, 2207, so that's why I ask.
Uh-huh.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you. And I... Maybe I just missed it. It was in there very subtly. But on the original program, the Nissan Leaf, you are installing these charging stations basically, with a purchase of a vehicle? Is it quite that simple, or?
Co-chair Benz, co-chair Reed, and Representative Beyer, if somebody is purchasing a Nissan Leaf, we will give them a free unit just like this one here, plus a discount on the fast charge port on the car, plus $1,500 of installation cost. So that's the package that comes with the purchase of a Nissan Leaf if you participate in the program and allow us to gather data on the vehicle use.
Please.
Thank you. And after that installation and they're able to collect all this data, is there any additional fee to them except for the cost of the electricity they're using?
No.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Mayfield.
Thank you.
Do you need this?
No. Okay. Good afternoon, co-chairs. Benson Reed and members of the committee. My name is Charlie Alcock. I am the Business Development Director for Portland General Electric, and I'm pleased this afternoon to come and talk to you a little bit from the utilities perspective on some of the experiences that we've had around electric vehicles charging and job creation here in Oregon. I wear a number of different hats at Portland General, but we started in this space working on electric vehicles, one from a technology standpoint, but certainly from the perspective of trying to understand the job creation opportunities that come from our involvement in this area. I'd like to focus my comments today in three areas. One is just our history and what we've learned along the way and our key learnings from that, and then just a sense of where this might go. And we've had an opportunity to look at other examples at other utilities around the country as well as in other countries, and I'd like to just share some of those thoughts and comments with you. We began our work with electric vehicles in 1996, which was a long time ago, with two Solectra vehicles that many of you may remember into our fleet, and with one single electric vehicle charging station curbside in front of the World Trade Center in downtown Portland. Since then, we've collected a lot of data. We've collected a lot of experiences from those two vehicles, and it was in the summer of 2008 when the transitions really began to occur, when we took advantage of a Toyota-sponsored international conference on urban mobility called the Meeting of the Minds that maybe perhaps some of you attended. We took that opportunity to update our charging station that had shown the wear of time, and we worked with Toyota to bring one of their plug-in Priuses to this event, and it became a little bit of a media event. We were absolutely surprised to see how much it became headlines news locally here in Oregon. It was certainly spread on the internet, and that's what caught Nissan's attention. And you've heard the Nissan story a little bit today, but that was the precipitation in the history. And when Nissan came knocking on our door here in Oregon, they were clearly looking for early sites from which to begin selling their electric vehicle, which we now know as the Leaf. They looked at clearly our favorable demographics, and they particularly paid a lot of attention to the fact that we have many Oregonians spend an extra $10 on their month for green power. Both Pacific Power and PGE rank very high across the country in that respect, and because of the very high per capita concentration of hybrid gasoline vehicles. The car companies wanted a relationship with the state, and the car companies wanted a relationship with the utility, because they've realized that the electric utility has now become an integral part of their fuel supply chain for their customers that are looking to buy their vehicles. So we began to realize that being the transportation fuel provider was a new frontier for us. We had a lot of learning to do, and we focused on three areas: understanding the impacts of electric vehicle charging on our grid, being able to educate our customers and answer their questions, and collaborate with the range of folks that you've heard about from through across the state on raising consumer awareness about this technology, and then leveraging all these technologies into future economic development opportunities for Oregonians. It was really in this spirit. So remember, this is summer of 2008. We did the charging station, got some of the media attention. By fall of 2008, we were surprised by being approached by many of our business customers who also wanted a charging station on their own premises. And we now have about 30 of our customers that have installed charging stations on their premises at their expense. And we help supplement with green power so that all the electricity that got delivered through those charging stations do come from green power resources. Assuming that these initial electric vehicle buyers that we are now beginning to see are most likely to follow those who bought hybrid gasoline vehicles, we began to look at the impacts on our grids and to see if the buying patterns were very similar and that's where they would locate, would our system be able to handle it? And the answer to that one was clearly a yes. We have the capacity, and looking at the rates at which these electric vehicles are likely to be sold, we are now convinced that we have the appropriate infrastructure in place. And if there was this concentration of buyers, let's say that every resident on a cul-de-sac all went out and bought an electric vehicle, that we could see this stuff happening early enough that we could then take the appropriate measures to add additional infrastructure in. We also learned that an electric vehicle is not that all electric vehicles are not the same. We've talked about plug-in hybrids, and we've talked about 100% battery electric vehicles. The plug-in hybrids have a very small battery in them. And as a result, the 110-volt circuit that you see in your homes and in buildings like this, in rooms like this, work just fine for plug-in hybrids. So there's a richness to this conversation that I think needs to develop as we move forward. Many of the earlier comments today have been with cars that are powered 100% by a lithium-ion battery. For those, you've got special requirements where you need the quicker charging. But the 110-volt circuits and that service is ubiquitous. It's readily available. And that certainly is an option. And it's really up in the air right now as to how many cars are going to be sold that are plug-in hybrids versus those that are 100% operated by a battery. We also started to take a hard look at quick charging. We were concerned about the impact that quick charging may have on our grid. We collaborated with the NEC Group of Japan to begin to understand that. They were kind enough to offer a DC quick charger that was installed at the World Trade Center. And we ran a number of tests with the Mitsubishi iMeet, lots of charging experiences and things of that sort. And we were convinced from those experiments that, again, there is not much impact on our grid. What we did learn, however, is that the battery acts very much like a thirsty human being, and that when one is very thirsty, in the first few minutes, one can drink a lot of water very quickly. The battery absorbs electricity very quickly in the first 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, but then one begins to slow down, and by the time you get to the fourth glass of water, if you really slow down the pace at which you drink, the battery acts the same way. So instead of thinking about, in the gasoline car analogy of saying, I'm going to run my car down to empty, and then I'm going to fill it up at the same rate, the electric car brings a very different kind of refueling experience to the table. And that was the thing that surprised us. And now that I think we're in a better spot to understand that recharging can occur, say, in the first 10 minutes, you can get 50 miles. And then in the next subsequent 10 minutes, you might get only 20 miles. So it's a different way of learning about refueling. We also took a look at some pricing of how much it would cost for fueling costs, and there have been some questions from the committee earlier today on this topic. Assuming that one drives 1,000 miles a month, the electricity cost needed to go that 1,000 miles on a battery electric vehicle is about $300. Now, if you were to drive the same 1,000 miles a month, going at 20 miles a gallon at $3.50 per gallon for gasoline, that cost is $2,100. So the annual savings is $1,800 a year. And that's roughly the scope of what we're talking about. In terms of CO2 emissions, using our existing current profile of generation resources that we own and operate as PGE, the reduction in carbon emissions by going to 100% battery electric vehicle is a 75% reduction. So those are some of the numbers that we can expect to see.
Mr. Chuck, if you could start to wind it up, I still have five witnesses. We have a committee that follows us, and the committee chair is much less patient than the two of us, and so we've learned.
Understood. Let me just say then that we have a public utility, Oregon Public Utility Commission docket that is underway to answer many of these questions about the role of electric utilities, the role of charging devices in charging stations and those kinds of things. And we also have some good news, examples of some good news for job creation, in that Eaton Corporation, which is another manufacturer of charging stations, has announced that they will be assembling quick chargers at their facility in Wilsonville. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is the $300, I'm trying to figure out, that's the cost of the electricity.
That's correct.
Not necessarily supplied to the machine through one of these devices.
No, that number, Co-Chair Benz, is a number that you would charge, you would need to pay if you charge at home.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Very interesting. Our next witnesses are James Mast, Mark Brady, and Jesse Oliver.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Benson and Reed, and members of the committee. My name is James Mast. I'm a senior project manager with the Portland Development Commission in Portland, with our offices located at 222 Northwest 5th Avenue. I'm going to speak very briefly today about the City of Portland's initiatives in relation to economic development around electric vehicles and energy storage, as well as broader initiatives to promote the adoption of EVs and to meet the city's climate action goals. Start off with a little bit of history. In 2009, recognizing the need to create the right environment to support EVs and capitalize on the significant economic development opportunities, the mayor designated a city point person on electric vehicles to coordinate city strategy, policy, and work with infrastructure providers. We've used that role to convene a cross-bureau working group of key agencies that touch on issues related to EVs and determine the best approaches to knock down barriers and support EV adoption. We've since developed and presented to the City Council in July of 2010 a city strategy, Electric Vehicles the Portland Way. The strategy aligns the city's economic development strategy as well as the city and Multnomah County's climate action plan goals. The document has guided our actions since that time. To assist in the goals of the city strategy, we've launched a public information and online permitting site for electric vehicles, chargeportland.com. One of the features of this site is a walkthrough of the permitting process that aligns with the state's terrific efforts to streamline permitting and just basically creates a walkthrough for individuals in Portland to get an online permit to put in a home charging stations like you see on the wall over there. In early 2009, the Portland Development Commission identified an emerging cluster of electric vehicle and related businesses operating in Portland. Once we recognized the span of companies involved, we enlisted the cooperation of Business Oregon to look beyond our borders. Our agencies have been working closely with Drive Oregon to convene businesses in this cluster, to start a dialogue, encourage communication, and focus on how to assist in the growth of these local businesses. The first roundtable for the group, which has now become Drive Oregon, it was held in spring 2009. Since the initial meeting, the group has focused on identifying core mission, establishing a set of values and strategic outlook for advancing the industry. Through the course of 2009 and 2010, the group held additional roundtables to establish consensus around the group's mission. The Portland Development Commission has worked closely with Drive Oregon as it evolved, providing limited financial and in-kind resources, including working with a facilitator, providing sponsorships, and providing meeting space. This working with this group has culminated in the opportunity to to go in front of the Oregon Innovation Council, and I'm going to let Mark Brady talk about that. And while we've provided some limited assistance, the Portland Development Commission has been very sensitive to make sure that the group has been self-sustaining. In line with the city's economic development strategy, PDC has been working to focus its efforts on this cluster of businesses, and in conjunction with the state has been working to recruit exciting players. One good recent example of which is Revolt Technology, which a number of you had asked earlier about battery technology. They're looking into advanced battery technologies to increase to decrease cost and increase range on vehicles. The city, along with its great partner, the state, won this the move of their headquarters with it because of its dedication to cooperation amongst all levels of government, as well as its commitment to clean tech and EVs. I'll conclude here with we strongly believe that by creating the right environment and continued collaboration between the city, state, utilities, and private partners, we can continue to be at the forefront on the electric vehicle market and continue to attract both public and private investment to this space. The city will continue to work to provide the right tools for its residents and promote electric vehicles both as an economic development tool and as a means to meet our climate action goals. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next may.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chairs Benson Reed and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Brady. I'm a clean tech strategist with Business Oregon. Today we're experiencing the start of a potentially significant shift from a transportation that's based almost entirely on fossil fuels and oil to one that increasingly relies on electricity as fuel. This shift will change vehicles, components, supply chains, infrastructure, utilities, building codes, and more. With a shift of this magnitude, there's obviously going to be opportunities around businesses and jobs. It's important to note that these opportunities exist well beyond light-duty vehicles. We had a mention of Nissan manufacturing earlier, but there's much more to it than just that. It's got energy storage, components within the vehicles, charging stations, software, non-traditional vehicles, etc. You've already heard Oregon's been doing a great job of positioning itself and exploiting its natural advantages as the place to launch these vehicles, but we're now getting international recognition of this as well. Recently, Oregon was given the EV industry's most prestigious award, as it's called the E-Visionary Award at the EVS 25 conference in China. Along the way, there have been some successes in business development, but we can and we intend to do more. Something to keep in mind when thinking about the economic opportunity here is that the EV and energy storage sectors are undergoing significant technological and market change and development. That means that we need to be nimble and flexible to respond as these jobs grow in these new sectors. Currently, we've got several things going on that I wanted to touch on today to highlight some of the work we're doing. First and foremost, we're working with our existing and already established businesses here in Oregon. You've heard mention of Drive Oregon. Jesse here will speak on that group in just a second. The group was recently chosen by the Innovation Council as the first new initiative to be included in its innovation plan for recommendation to the governor and the legislature. With this additional state support through the innovation plan, these businesses could leverage significant outside funding and bring additional jobs to Oregon. Second area we work in is on the recruitment side of things. There's obviously existing businesses that look for new facilities from time to time. And the state continues to work with these companies to identify the right opportunities that fit with the resources and the capabilities we have in the state and they complement the existing industry we have here. We've recently seen an increasing number of inquiries along these lines, particularly on the energy storage side of things. It's also been a significant topic of interest at the federal level. The state always works with its partners to exploit those opportunities whenever possible. Art James covered a couple of successful grant awards that we've received recently. But on the private side, private organizations have received more than $70 million in private funds for electric transportation projects in the last couple of years. These projects range from advanced battery research to truck stop electrification to ultracapacitor manufacturing. These are exciting companies that are creating jobs in Oregon today and are poised for additional growth in the future. I also want to touch on a few specific examples of companies who are here now. You've already seen the Arcimoto vehicle in the slideshow earlier. There's Brammo and Ashland producing electric motorcycles. Got Intech International that Art James referenced that's producing lithium-ion battery separators for Johnson Controls, and got a significant funding from a federal grant that Johnson Controls received. Energy 2 in Albany partnered with Oregon Freeze Dry to land a federal grant for an energy storage manufacturing plant. And Amphor Electronics, Jesse's company, is realizing supply chain opportunities in the EV sector. I also wanted to share one last anecdote of a company that's particularly interesting. It's probably one most people have never heard of, called Reinhart Motion Systems. Besides other engineering projects, this Wilsonville company designed what's called a KERS system for Formula One racers. I don't know if anybody here is a Formula One fan, but this system is, KERS stands for Kinetic Energy Recovery System, and essentially it takes some of the braking energy when the cars go into turns, stores it, and then provides it out as a boost to the cars when it comes out of the turn. So this small Oregon company designed a system that's going to be used in this year's races. And on top of that, they designed the very first system in the entire world that fit with Formula One's specifications. This is, again, a company probably nobody's heard of, but it's a few examples of the type of innovation and capabilities we have here in Oregon around EVs. The last piece of the state strategy I want to mention is that we're working with our partners to generate interest in Oregon to be the place to deploy innovative projects. We've hosted numerous companies, and there's been excitement. They're very excited to see what Oregon's doing, but we need to turn these into concrete projects. And together with our partners, we can create the right environment for these projects to be successful, and then if they are successful, the momentum behind those will draw interest and attention to Oregon as the place to put your business when you look to expand your business and add employees. In conclusion, the shift to electric transportation is setting the stage for significant growth in jobs and businesses in EVs and energy storage sectors, and the state is working closely with its partners to realize as much benefit from this shift as possible. Thank you very much, chairs and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brady. I think we'll go to Mr. Oliver first. Mr. Sure. Oliver, I hate to keep you too succinct, but we have about 11 minutes left, so how about using three of them, and then we can bring our other three witnesses up, if you don't mind.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
Chair Vince, Chair Reed, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Jesse Oliver. I'm a director of sales with Amphor Electronics. I'm here today as a representative of Drive Oregon. I've distributed a presentation for everyone. I won't bore you with reading through that. I'd just like to call attention to three slides. Slide 14 talks about the mission of our group to catalyze the growth of Oregon's electric vehicle industry, ensuring Oregon develops and maintains its competitive advantage and maximizes the economic development potential of the emerging industry. So that's who we are. That's what we're about. And then the next slide is going to be slide 16, two pages past. And that talks about who we are as far as, you know, the representative industry. So we're looking across vehicle types, and we've determined that's from bikes all the way to electric trains, light rail type systems. We're looking at all levels of integration. So components like my company, we do wiring harnesses and electronic subassemblies. So for instance, on the Brembo motorcycle, mm-hmm. our company makes the wiring harnesses that connects the batteries to the lights and connects all the electrical systems. So from the component level all the way up to vehicle management to software and development, and then including infrastructure. So that's including the utilities, including the charging stations. The next slide is slide 17, and that gives you a representative idea of the companies that, you know, this is not exhaustive, but the companies that are signed on with Drive Oregon, and that includes EcoSpeed, Amphor Electronics, Shore Power, Greenlight Motors, Arcimoto, Brammo, Revolt, Kerstech, Entech, and many other companies. So these companies are across the board, across the spectrum. These companies are employing people right now, and companies like ours are growing because of the opportunity in the electric vehicle industry. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oliver, for keeping that short. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Widener.
Just real quick, and it might be something we may want to have ODOT and the insurance company to look into, but with these being electric motors, you're dealing with a constant torque. So I can see kids really souping up some cars and making them really fast. So has that been taken into consideration? Because we all know about the Tesla and having a constant torque curve and it making a Ferrari look silly. There's a bunch of other cars there that you could probably kind of do the same thing with. Has that been taken into consideration when we're designing these cars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, do you have plans?
I'll tell you, I actually came close to spending the $100,000 on a Tesla at one time because I would have saved it on fuel cost and had a car that would do 0 to 60 in like 2.4 seconds.
Co-Chairs Benson Reed, Representative Widener. The extent of my knowledge on that is with the Nissan vehicle. They understand the issue you're talking about and have actually actively limited the ability of the electric motor to torque the wheels right at the start. So the major designers are certainly thinking of that and limiting it. Whether or not they're protecting it well enough to get ahead of the 16-year-old boys that are going to be trying to tweak those systems, I can't personally say. But I know it's certainly on their mind that these things have the ability to dramatically accelerate beyond what traditional internal combustion engines can.
The reason it comes up, I have a diesel truck that, without my programmer, it's about 300 foot-pounds of torque. I put it in, I'm at 700 foot-pounds of torque, and it's a whole different beast. And this could easily do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Weidner. Thank you. Are there further questions? Thank you so much, panel. Very interesting presentation. Final three witnesses, Peggy Woolsey, Joe Esmond, and Charlie Alcock is coming back up, I think, if he wants to. Wants to go first. Please.
Okay. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I am with Tax Fairness Oregon. Chair Bentz, Chair Reed, nice to see you all, and members of the committee. I don't really have a dog in the fight on this. I love the idea of the electric vehicles, and I appreciate the fact that Oregon is encouraging the manufacture and the marketing here in Oregon. I'm concerned about the bill as I read it, allowing the agencies to install the meters that seem to be giving the electricity free to the people who plug in. Now, that could be the visitors to the agency. It could be lobbyists or legislators or other state employees. But looking at it from the point of a retired state employee, the state employees are quite often targets of a lot of animosity because of all the benefits that they have. I don't think it's a good idea to make this a free service. I think it should be metered and paid for. And the bill did not make that clear. So I think that that's where I'm coming from. I think that this would add to the agency's budget. If they only had one or two meters, it wouldn't be a lot, but it adds up over a year's time. And I think that paying for the cost of the fuel is simply part of the overall cost of owning any vehicle, whether it's a biodiesel, a hydrocarbon-operated fuel, or electricity. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Joe?
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Wesman. I am the green guy for the IBW 48 in Portland, Oregon. And I'm probably the only electrician in the room. So, a couple quick things. We have been working with, sorry to use a hackneyed word, partners, because they produce, this produces jobs. We have 30 to 35% unemployment among our trade in the state of Oregon, and this is one way we could put some people back at the work. We have volunteered our services a couple years ago up in Portland to get free assessments to how to run the pipe underground or above, which would help the cost savings. Another thing, my pension on the international level, they just invested in battery storage in Kansas City, and they invested in a fleet of trucks. So we are very interested in this technology, and it's not a big deal to run a pipe out this wall and down and put a charging station up outside. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again. I'm Charlie Alcock. This time I am here representing the Governor's Transportation Electrification Executive Committee. Jeff Kogan, who is the Multnomah County Commission Chair, is the chair of that council. Unfortunately, he was unable to be here today, so he asked me to speak to the committee on behalf of the council as I serve as vice chair. You are being circulated a copy of the executive order that was signed by Governor Kulongoski last fall that set up our council and our charter and our mission. And the bottom line is that we have a report due to the governor in August of this year, and we have a work plan and mission statement and those kinds of activities currently underway. And while the council has not formally met to and adopted the work plan and the recommendations, I can give you a little bit of an insight today on where I think the council is going to end up. The council will probably say that the best learning that we need will occur from actual experiences by Oregon residents and Oregon businesses with a broad range of electric vehicles, charging infrastructure, and related systems. To the extent that we have benefited from being a premier launch market in North America, the next goal is to become the premier adoptive market. And that just means a lot of cars on the road and a lot of Oregonian residents and businesses learning how this technology works. By doing that, one then attracts the other supply chain and the other companies, and it provides the opportunities for Oregon businesses to take advantage of the natural collection that begins to occur as the industry begins to focus its deployment in certain areas. And this is a very nascent industry. There'll be plenty of time to see how this thing shakes up over the next biennium. We have the EV project and many other studies underway. So we can learn from that during the next biennium so that perhaps the regulatory work needs to be more on the incentive side than on the controlling side of things. And finally, the third recommendation will most likely be a focus on fleets. Those fewer decision makers affecting a larger number of cars, and when Oregonians begin to see that state governments, local governments, and well-known companies in Oregon can use this technology, they will get the confidence that this could, too, could be a transportation option for them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? See none. Thank you very much. That concludes the list I have here. Is anyone else want to speak? Seeing no others, I close the informational meeting and the work session on House Bill 2207 and adjourn the committee for today. Thank you.
Do you have a work session?